This is Alex Kraner.
This is Dave Collum.
This is Bruce Party.
Hi, this is Jeremy McKenzie, the Raging Dissident.
Hello, this is Maxime Bernier.
This is Danny Bulford.
This is Chuck Prodnick.
This is Vance Crowe, and you're listening to the Sean Newman Podcast.
Welcome to the podcast, folks. Happy Wednesday. How's everybody doing today? Well, I'm doing pretty good. That's me. It's hump day. How you doing? How you doing, folks? All right. The world is a mess. Yes, agreed. 2024 is shaping up to be a geopolitical storm. Yep. Now might be a time to diversify some of your hard-earned earnings savings into some of your hard-earned savings. Ugh. I'm going to say that again. Now might be the perfect time to diversify some of your hard-earned savings into physical money that can't be printed. Talking about gold and silver. Silver Gold Bull, they're North America's premier precious metals dealer with state-of-the-art distribution centers in Alberta, that's Calgary, and Nevada, that's Las Vegas. Silver Gold Bull ensures fast, fully insured, discreet shipping right to your doorstep. They offer a full suite of services to help you buy, sell, and store your precious metals. And if you've never done it yet, where it ships directly to your doorstep, there's something cool about that. Like, it's slick, you know? Type it in, boom, 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 check, check, check. It doesn't take long. Does it take 5 minutes? I don't even know if it takes 5 minutes. Boom. And then you just wait and it shows up on your doorstep. And I've sat in this studio now and given out 1 ounce silver coins to people. And it's pretty cool to watch. And if you've never experienced that, you should treat yourself. And well, Silver Gold Bull, they got a special offer specifically for us. For the Sean Newman podcast, this is an offer for us, okay? It's everyone's favorite silver coin. So if you've never had a silver coin, well, it's everyone else's favorite, okay? The Royal Canadian Mint Silver Maple Leaf. This offer is only available on, it's not available on the site. It's only available here. This is the only place you're hearing about it. And it's only open for us. All you got to do is call or email Graham for details. So that's what you got to do. Call him. See what the details are. Report back. Let me know if you bought some, you didn't buy some, you found out information. What did you do? Ba, 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 ba. Silvergoldbull.ca, down in the show notes, all the details, okay? That's what we're talking about. Caleb Taves, Renegade Acres, well, he does Community Spotlight. Community Spotlight this week, SMP Presents is back April 27th in Lloydminster, Armstrong virtually, Luongo Craner in person, Chris Sims in person, Curtis Stone in person, Chuck Prodnick in person. We're doing a full day conference. It's called the Cornerstone Forum, and it should be, well, it's gonna be a fun day. I hope to see you there. I think it's gonna be a ton of fun, and yeah, like I say, I hope to see you there. Go down in the show notes. That's where you can find all the information. March 14th, Thursday, March 14th, For the Kids' Sake is back. We have Shelby Boyd and Tasha Fishman, both of them coming in to talk about homeschooling and a few other things going on around the schools. So if you're in Lloydminster on March 14th, that'll be 7 p.m. at the Legacy Center. The Deer and Steer Butchery, they got a new lady cutting up the meat. That's right, a butcheress. A dealer in meat. Man, that sounds cool. She's a mother too. Was born and raised in the small town of Wadena? Don't know why it sounds wrong today. Saskatchewan. So, small town sass girl cutting up your meat. What can go wrong? Nothing. That's right. She's been cutting meat since she was 16. She took her retail meat cutting of Nate, went apprentice at the Real Deal Meats in Edmonton, and has worked in Ontario in the St. Lawrence Market, which is one of the biggest fresh produce meat and seafood vendors in Canada. So stop in and see the Deer and Steer today. Give them a call, 780-870-8700. If you got an animal, they can get you in and rolling. Erickson Agro Incorporated, Irma, Alberta, has Kent and Tasha Erickson, family farm raising 4 kids, growing food for their community and this great country. Did I mention SMP Presents? I think I did. Oh, man. I'm excited. Here we go. Let's get on to that tail of the tape, shall we? He served in the Canadian military for 14 years as a radio signaler. He served in 3 tours in Afghanistan and was medically released after suffering shrapnel wounds, traumatic brain injury, and 50% hearing loss and nerve damage after being hit by an IED strike while on foot patrol. I'm talking about Tobias Miller. So buckle up. Here we go. Welcome to the Sean Newman Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Tobias Miller. Thank you, sir, for hop on.
I'm happy to be here. It's a pleasure.
Whereabouts are you these days?
We're in Puerto Penasco, Mexico, so about 4 hours south of Phoenix, right on the ocean, the Sea of Cortez.
I honestly, I'm curious, what took you down there?
Well, so we sort of left Canada after, I mean, we're both retired military, my wife and I, and we left Canada. We've got a fifth wheel. We're looking to travel. We can only do 182 days a year in the U.S. We fell in love with Texas and Arizona. We'd happily be there full time if we could. But we had to leave after 6 months, and I didn't want to go back up to Canada in winter, so it was south of the border time.
So you're basically an expat living in both the states, splitting time between states and Mexico.
Yeah, that was the general plan. And now we've actually settled into Mexico and we're enjoying it. And we may just sort of stick around here. We're not sure yet, but we just sort of play it fast and loose. That's the beauty of having a fifth wheel, and we can move it if we want.
Has this always been the case? Were you always living out of a fifth wheel, or did something change that you're like, we're heading out of here?
Well, we've actually got a really beautiful house on Vancouver Island. We're retired from the military. We're both I'm a wounded combat veteran, and we were done. We had no sort of obligations. We had our house, but the weather gets to me. The politics get to me a bit. The economy certainly gets to me. We jokingly refer to ourselves as economic refugees down here. It's much cheaper to live. And we wanted to see some parts of the world. We wanted to travel around a bit. We have two huge dogs, so we can't exactly be flying all over the place. So fifth wheel was the next best option. Well, we have the dogs.
Now, Tobias, you got to tell us a little bit about yourself. You know, I certainly I'm curious about Mexico and living out of a fifth wheel trailer and everything else. But, you know, you get thrown my way because of your military service and your background. You've alluded to that. I don't know where you want to start, but I'm along for the ride today. Tell, you know, where did you grow up? How did you get into the military? And let's talk a little bit about it.
Sure. Well, I was born in Winnipeg. I spent probably the first 12 years of my life in Manitoba, and then moved to the West Coast. I was a professional diver on the West Coast after high school. I spent a number of years as a diver. Moved to Calgary just for
you
work.
You mean like professional diver, like dumping off a diving board and doing the, you know, and on and on and on?
No, I mean gear on 100 feet underwater. Working aquaculture, light commercial salvage. I was an instructor, a dive trainer. So I've got somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 dives, you know, so I spent a lot of time underwater. And then came a point where for work, I moved to Alberta, and then 9/11 happened, and I felt the call to join the forces. So I joined the armed forces in 2002 as a radio operator, a signaler. I went to Afghanistan on my first tour in 2003, literally only 10 or 11 months after I joined the Army. I was in Afghanistan on my first tour, and that was up north in Kabul. After that, I did a full 15 years in the military. I did two more tours in Afghanistan. I did an 11-month tour in 2008-2009 on the close protection party for the task force commander of all of Kandahar province. And then I went again. Well, after that tour, I joined Canadian Special Operations Regiment. I went from the Green Army to the Special Operations side, and I deployed with them in 2011 to Afghanistan, and I was wounded on that tour.
Okay. So 9/11, I've heard lots about. For you, you watched it. I was in high school at the time. And I remember exactly where I was at during 9/11 and how everything happened then. You were older at that time. I believe you mentioned you were 32 roughly.
I was 32 years old when I went to basic training. It was, I saw what happened. I had friends in the military. I had always wanted to be in the military. I'd sort of put it off for other things, had children and stuff like that, so I didn't join. And then when 9/11 happened, there was just a call to me that, you know, this was something that had to be answered. This was an attack on, I don't know, North American values, on North America itself, and that it was large-scale terrorism of the kind we hadn't seen before, and I wanted to do something. So I went down to the recruiting station and attempted to join as an infanteer, and what I got offered was an opportunity to go in as a radio operator, and I jumped at it. I took it, and I swore into the military end of April 2002, and I was into Afghanistan, like I said, probably about 11 months later.
Forgive me, radio operator. When you say that, what I think of a guy running around with a backpack calling in things and not haul around the big Gatling gun or what have you. What is a radio operator?
It's a broad trade. It can be everything from the guys that are working computers and stuff like that. Most of my career, I was doing exactly what you said. I had a man pack radio on my back. And I would patrol with infanteers or with a close support unit, doing close protection for the task force commander, carrying a rifle, carrying a plate carrier, full gear like everybody else, but then add a big-ass radio to it.
And were you in the same, once again, forgive me, folks, were you in the same, grouping, company? I don't know. Or did you bounce from group to group? Now, the reason I ask that is because I feel like in military movies, the radio guy always seems to be like, we need a radio guy. And then they bring in a radio guy and you go off this way and then you come back and you go off with a different group. Is that factual or is that a complete BS?
That can be kind of factual. I mean, the fact of the matter is radio operators generally, like SIGOPs, they call us signals operators, are one of one. There's only one of you anytime a unit is going out or a patrol is going out, unless there's a big headquarters. If it's just a small unit, there's only one of you. And so they grab whoever they can get their hands on generally. That sort of was different when I got into special operations. With special operations, they have a guy who is sort of their dedicated signaler, their dedicated radio operator. But when I was with the Green Army, we'll call it, the regular army, there was a lot of going out on taskings to different units. I was lucky in that at some point in time, I was tasked to be the brigade commander's personal radio operator in Petawawa, Ontario. And I got on with him and I worked directly for him for about a year. And then he took over the position of Task Force Commander Kandahar. So he was command of all of the troops in Kandahar, U.S. Marines, Canadian troops, everybody. And he asked me to go over and be his radio operator on that tour in Afghanistan. And that's how I wound up on my second tour. And that was part of a very small unit. It's his protection party. We would have two light armored vehicles and about a dozen guys. And I was one of those guys.
And what do you remember? What was that experience like?
That was an incredible experience because it's Brigadier General Thompson. He's an outstanding guy. He does not like to lead from his office. He leads from the front. So in our LAV-3 armored vehicles, we traveled 17,000 kilometers on those roads in that 10 to 11 months. And that's a lot of mileage through IED terrain. He was always going out to meet with forward troops and to sort of support them. He actually patrolled himself. He actually was in an IED strike himself, which is kind of crazy for a brigadier general. But it was a very exciting tour because he was all over Kandahar province. We went from the Pakistan border all the way towards northern Afghanistan and as far east as we could get or west as we could get. And it was a great tour. It was very interesting because I saw all of pretty much Kandahar province in that tour.
Tell me a little bit about Kandahar province or Afghanistan in general, because you're talking to a civilian who's never been there.
Right. Well, I mean, Afghanistan's a very interesting place. It has huge mountains. It also has rolling red sand deserts like you would see in a movie, sand dunes. It's got some very green parts, but it's also a lot of desolation. the cities are very, at back then, were very desolate. They'd been bombarded through tribal warfare before we got there. There was a lot of displaced people, no homes. The infrastructure was non-existent. Part of what we were trying to do was build up infrastructure. And Kandahar province itself is the home to the Taliban. That's where they started, and that's where they sort of headquartered out of. So when we moved from Kabul up in northern Afghanistan down to the southwest to Kandahar province, it was a game changer. We went from being in danger of maybe some mines and IEDs to danger of actual gunfights, because the Taliban wanted to protect Kandahar province. They wanted to stand up and protect it, and they were willing to hold their ground. And that made for a whole different war when the Canadian military moved into southern Afghanistan in about 2006.
What did you think when everybody pulled out of Afghanistan?
That was heartbreaking. You know, I mean, it was very difficult. I've lost a lot of friends in Afghanistan. You know, I've lost a half a dozen to suicide post-Afghanistan, but I've lost six or eight friends in Afghanistan in combat, and was wounded myself. I left my blood on that soil, and it was very difficult to watch the waste of blood and treasure. You know, to see that everything we had put in, we dumped in as ISAF, as NATO. ISAF is the International Security Assistance Force, which was the NATO body that was in Afghanistan. We had dumped in something ridiculous, trillions and trillions of dollars, and thousands of allied lives, and thousands more wounded, to replace the Taliban with a better armed Taliban. You know, so I mean, that was a tough blow to watch, and I know it was that way for most Afghan vets I know, to watch the running retreat, you know, out of Kandahar.
I don't know how to phrase this, but we'll try here. Does it make you wish, you know, like that you, not that you'd never went, but, you know, like seeing where it ends to where it started and how you get pulled in? And I don't know how much you've looked into 9/11. I don't know if you believe in any of those thoughts, but do you see how you're pulled in and then to see how they leave and everything else? Do you go, man, that was, you know, and to be wounded on top of it? Do you look at that and go, not that you regret it by any stretch, just what are your thoughts now as you're removed from it?
I don't regret it. I mean, the fact of the matter is I had grandfathers who fought in World War II, which was a big righteous war, and it ended, you know, as it should have, in victory. And I don't really think that we've seen a military victory since then in sort of North America. It's an unpopular opinion to state amongst other veterans, but fact of the matter is, as far as I'm concerned with Afghanistan, we lost. I mean, we went in there, we spent all that blood and treasure, and the Taliban are still in power, you know. So while we were not losing battles, and I heard it said by Vietnam veterans when I was growing up, you know, they didn't lose battles when they lost the war, and we didn't lose battles against the Taliban, but politically, it was a loss, you know. The Taliban are still in control, and you know, do I regret it? No. I was there with my brothers and sisters, and I was doing a job I loved doing. And I was, you know, I liken this to sort of like a football player. If you practice and practice and practice, you want to play in the big game at some point. If you train and train and train as a soldier, at some point in time, you want to be tested in battle. And I had the opportunity to be tested in battle for about 24 months in total. So I don't regret it, but I do think it was wasteful. And in most ways, you know, I think that I said to somebody the other day, I said, stupid wars have stupid endings. and watching the way Afghanistan played out at the end, and I suspect Iraq is playing out similarly or will eventually, you know, it just makes me question whether or not, you know, if we're not willing to put in the political stick-to-itiveness or wherewithal, if we're not willing to commit, make that full long-term commitment, then should we be there in the first place, you know? And going into Afghanistan, this is a tribal country. These people have been at war for thousands of years, either between themselves or the British or the Russians or then NATO. These are people who war. That's what they do. And if you want to change attitudes of people in Afghanistan for women's rights, children's rights, protection and safety of children, etc., you're talking about a generational conflict. You know, you're talking about having to be there generations to make those changes. And we weren't, nobody is willing to put in, I don't know, lives for generations. Because while you're in the doing the generational warfare and counterinsurgency, you're going to be losing guys. And no country in the Western world is willing to lose guys for generation after generation after generation. And as it was, we had, you know, Afghanistan went on long enough that that there were people who served in Afghanistan whose fathers served in Afghanistan. You know, we had young troops show up over there at 19 years old whose dad was in Afghanistan in 2001. You know, so it was an interesting situation. But I mean, if you ask me, at the end of the day, was it worth it? Not really. The Taliban's still there, and that's the only metric I have to go off of.
What do you think of? Everyone will have to forgive my curiosity, because anytime I get a military vet on, I just think, you know, we do a military roundtable once a month where we try and, you know, pull out some of the experiences and thoughts of a very small part of the population of Canada, right? It's very, very tiny. And as it sits today, you know, I could pull you in the direction of menstrual products in the men's bathroom and see your thoughts on that. But I feel like I probably got a pretty good gauge of where you're gonna go. And every other military vet goes on that. How about what's going on? You know, like today, I don't know how much you think about it, but it feels like from time to time, and it depends how much I stare at social media or the news, the talk of World War III, and they don't really label it World War III. You know, there's global conflict, I would say, is more the terminology they use. Do you think about it much? Do you pay attention to it at all?
I do. I mean, it's hard not to pay attention to, you know, sort of, I mean, for one thing, it's interesting to watch in the Ukraine that we've gone back in some ways to World War I type fighting with trench warfare, etc. But with the addition of drones dropping mortar rounds directly onto individual troops, right? Targeted drone attacks. So it's a very strange situation. I think that the world is unstable, you know, and it's inherently unstable, but that we're reaching a point of less stability every day. And I don't know where that's coming from. Is it part of it's media driven? Some of it's social media driven. We created the internet, and the internet has given us so many incredible things. But one of the things it's given us is the ability to, well, to lie globally, you know, to put forward an agenda, and for the agenda to not just be heard by the people within earshot, but for everyone in the world to hear it. And so you can get nation states or terrorist groups that can spread a message far and wide. And I think that one of the other things that social media maybe has done is we're no longer as critical thinkers as we used to be. So people take things at face value a little more. You know, we're a clickbait society or a headline society. You read the headline, but I don't have time to read the whole post. I can't be bothered. I got crap to do and more pages to scroll. Right. So now I base my bias, my opinion, etc., off of what that headline said. So then we have people who are getting very good at writing headlines that are not necessarily, if you read a headline and it says what it says, if you're going to read the meat of the story really is not actually saying what the headline led you to believe, right? But our society has a tendency to just click the headline and go, yeah, that's good. I got the info now, and move on. My wife's a former intelligence person, military intelligence. So I'm well schooled by her all the time on read past the headline, right, and dig a little deeper. And I think that as a society, we sort of fail to do that. And organizations will take advantage of that. You know, organizations that are involved in global terror, nation states that want to destabilize our states, and things like that. It's the old Irish toast, may you live in interesting times. And I'm not sure if that's a toast or a curse, because we're living in interesting times, and it's kind of scary some days.
What did you think, you know, having a wife that was in military intelligence, what did you two think of the Putin-Tucker interview?
I actually have only watched parts of it. And I, you know, I recognize that there's two sides to every story. I'm not a guy who's a believer that, that Vladimir Putin is a good man or ever has been a good man. He's a KGB man. And I think that when you're a KGB man, you're a KGB man for life. I don't trust him. Do I think that everything that's said about him is, you know, necessarily fact? Do I take all of it at face value? No. I do know that the organization that he used to be so high up in is not an organization that was built on trust or, and I would say this in that I don't trust anybody who was high up in the CIA either. I think that if you inherently come out of an intelligence community, you have biases and you're going to, certainly if you're now in a position to run a country and you've come up out of the intelligence community, I just don't find that, that there's all, I have to take everything you say with a grain of salt, you know? I mean, we're talking about an organization that, the KGB, that is, that helped keep its people basically enslaved for years. And while that changed through Perestroika and the, you know, when the wall came down and all the rest of it, they hold a lot of sway now, still, the FSB. It's no longer the KGB, it's the FSB. But the FSB, they hold power. And Vladimir Putin has them in his pocket for sure. So, you know, I what do I think of the interview itself? I don't know. I think that it was interesting to watch a lot of journalists be pissed off at Tucker Carlson for going because, well, I mean, Tucker was doing what journalists are supposed to do. Go ask questions, right? And, you know, you've seen people interview Idi Amin. You've seen people interview, you know, all kinds of dictators all over the world. And nobody gave them trouble for doing it. And then people, because of, I think, probably Tucker's political viewpoints, went after him for that, you know, but he was doing what a journalist is supposed to do, go and ask questions of the people who the populace wants to hear the answers from, you know, and I think that it's a shame that we will look at somebody's political viewpoint, whether that's left or right. And I really, you know, I'm a conservative, I'm a dyed-the-wool conservative, always have been, but I'm a military guy, so that's not a surprise. I'm economically heavily conservative, but I just, to watch people's attitudes based off of somebody's political viewpoint and then to judge their work based off of their political viewpoint, really sort of, I don't get on with that much. You know, I mean, I don't care who you vote for. Do you go and look for the truth as a journalist, you know, and do you report that truth without bias? That's the biggest thing. You know, I think we're a world that misses the Walter Winchells and the, you know, the old school journalism. We could stand to have some of it back where they're not trying to tell you what you should think, but just tell you what happened and you can decide what to think.
Well, one of the things I admire about my audience is we let people on. We let them talk. We let them explore their thoughts. And that's what's lovely about podcasts, right? Because even, you know, you go any podcast that holds a guest on for longer than 15 minutes, you're going to get to hear their thoughts. And then it's on you to listen to it and think critically. And that's what I loved about the Tucker Putin interview. Is Putin the greatest human being on the planet? No. But he shows how weak our leaders are in the West, right? Because whether his background and the KGB and everything else makes him the most ruthless leader on the planet, I don't know. But what I can tell you is the way he projected himself, the way he answered questions, the way he went back and forth with Tucker Carlson, although given in a different language, put Trudeau beside him, put Biden beside him. And it's no question who the strongest leader is out of those three. It's not even a question. And that's what we're up against. We're up against a foe that has been pushed into a corner by looks of it with NATO and now has been pushed into war by different agreements that weren't honored, possibly. And you go, when he's getting interviewed by Tucker, and I've seen Tucker in person, Tucker's no slouch, and he has his way, That shows you all you need to, like, to me, that interview could have went 6 hours, because the more he talked, the better off it is. And that's what's lovely about podcasts, I think, Tobias.
I agree with that. You know, I mean, the fact of the matter is where the man comes from. It's his background is what makes him a strong leader, right? We don't have presidents and prime ministers who have served their nation in any way other than politics in a lot of cases. You know, our current prime minister, whatever his, you know, I mean, I generally don't talk too much about him because I'm not a huge fan. I'm not a fan at all, actually. But the fact of the matter is a guy who's never really held much of a job and who's never really held a lot of life experience, certainly not a lot of, you know, time in the political arena. And then you look at a guy like Joe Biden, who's been in the political arena most of his life. But where does their strength lie, right? Where does that strength come from? Vladimir Putin's a guy who served in uniform, who served a nation that was very military, and still is to this day very military, and that served in an organization that was very military, and was fighting through a Cold War, which we like to say, oh, it's just the Cold War. But for those organizations, it was a very real conflict. You know, our armies didn't go to battle against each other, but our military intelligence communities and our intelligence communities as a whole went to battle against each other in battles of wits and for years, decades. And he came up through that. He's a strong dude. There is no doubt whatsoever. And I think that one of our failings in our current political climates in the Western world is that we're trying to be all things to everybody all the time. And that's not leadership. If you water down, you know, I mean, coming up in the military, the leaders that I respected were leaders that when there was time to listen to you and to take your questions, et cetera, they would do so. And when there wasn't time to do so, you damn well did what you were told, because they're in charge and that's the job. Go, move. You know, I don't have time for this right now. Let's roll. That sort of strength and leadership is something that I think that we lack in our political arena, right? We spread ourselves too thin. We want to be everyone's friend. You want to be a friend to every special interest group out there because they're the voters and you want their votes. And if you follow along with every special interest group, and in that I count the military, right? They're a special interest group. Firearms owners, I am one. That's a special interest group. You know, LGBTQ, special interest group. The Muslim Council of Canada, special interest group. The Christian organizations, special interest groups. If you try to cater to all of them all the time, first off, you're going to have to be lying to somebody, and because their needs are opposite to each other on a regular basis, or their desires. So you're going to be lying to somebody if you're catering to all of them, and I think that it weakens your position. I've sort of strayed away from politics as I retired from the military and my watch of it. But my sense of it is that we just don't have a lot of strength in places that we should. We're lacking strength in leadership.
You know, you said something there that I guess is sticking with me. And that is, although we didn't go full on Russia versus the United States or North America, even now, with NATO essentially fighting, it's Ukraine fighting the Russians, but I mean, we're literally, like, is there anybody at this point that's going, we're not fighting the Russians? I mean, honestly, it's being funded by billions and billions and billions of dollars by North America, among other places. And if I look back through history, even the Cold War, although we didn't come to, I don't know because I wasn't there. But you just think of all the proxy wars where it was basically Russia, U.S. going at it mano a mano over and over and over again. You're a guy who probably has, I don't know, ran into the Russians at times, whether or not I don't mean like armed conflict. I just mean, like, is it maybe my question is, in North America, do we have this sense? Well, we've never really been in conflict, and I'm not putting those words in your mouth. I'm just meaning general population. Is it like, well, we've never really been in conflict, whereas the Russians have had it on their doorstep or closer to their doorstep, where it's like, no, we're at war for the very soul of who we are. And the North Americans have no idea because they're playing it out on all these proxy states like it's not that big a deal, when it is a really big deal.
Yeah, you know, there's a difference there when in World War II, I mean, Hawaii was hit one time, a great grave mistake on the Japanese behalf, I believe, because, you know, if they'd let the American sleeping war machine sleep, you know, we could have had an absolutely different outcome. But North America has never really been targeted. Like, nobody is, other than 9/11 terrorist attacks and things like that, nobody has attempted to invade here. And the Russians have been invaded within people's memory lifetime, you know? I mean, there are very few World War II vets left, but there are some World War II vets still alive in Russia that remember Stalingrad, you know? These are, and they push that history, and that's somewhere else that I feel like we lack on occasion. We don't recognize our history. We don't remember our history. We don't teach our history well. Yeah. I mean, we talk about, you know, yeah, well, we were involved in World War II. We were considered, you know, amazing troops in World War II. In World War I, we were stormtroopers. We were demanded for by the British generals because of our fighting power prowess. And those aren't things that we ever teach to our kids in school. And we spent, well, I mean, I've never been in an army at peace. When I joined, we were at war in Afghanistan. And when I left, we were in Iraq and Syria with special operations. So I've never been in a peacetime army. But I can guarantee you that my children were never taught about Afghanistan in school. And I very much doubt that my granddaughter will be taught about our country's longest war. You know, 2001, we rolled into Afghanistan and we pulled our last troops out in 2014, and it didn't fall completely for NATO until 2 years ago. And I think that, you know, that is something that definitely should be taught, and it won't be. And that's a mistake on our part, because it is a piece of our history which we should be justifiably proud that our troops did stand up and that they did as well as they did and that they accomplished everything they accomplished. The lack of political will is not their fault. You know, the lack of political power to put behind the war is not their fault. They did an incredible job, and it's something that should be taught in our history, but it won't be, because I really feel like as Canadians, one of the things we do is we like to say, you know, we like to downplay ourselves. We don't hand out medals the way other nations do. You know, the Canadian Victoria Cross has never been handed out, ever. And Lord knows there were numerous occasions in the war in Afghanistan where Canadian troops displayed valor that was worthy of the Victoria Cross. But because we are the people we are, Canadians, no applause, please, we're Canadian. You know, that we also won't teach these things. And so we run risk of losing our history if we don't do that, you know, if we don't push our stories forward into the future with our future generations, then they don't get to learn from it either. And that's a shame. And that's, you know, if you fail to remember your history, you're doomed to repeat it, right? That's the saying. And I think that we have an obligation to be teaching those our history and all of our history, not just the pretty stuff. You know, we need to be teaching everything. We need to teach about the great things we've done and the bad things we've done. I said that about, you know, the removing of statues in some places, that, you know, they're a piece of history, and I think that if you hide it away, that's a shame. Instead, what should be done maybe is there should be some truth told about on that statue. You know, this person did this, and they did this great thing for the country and this great thing, but they also did this, this, and this. And let people make a decision. Let people be critical thinkers and make a decision about that piece of history.
Well, the thing that comes to mind is George Orwell. Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past. And that book terrifies me on so many different levels. It's not even funny. But they're like, and probably the reason why it terrifies me is things like that, that just map so perfectly onto where we're at these days. You know, I could sit and talk all this for hours. You know, in your email you mentioned, and you've mentioned briefly, and I haven't given it its due course, which is, you know, you're injured on you're hit by an IED, and you've had a journey with that. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about that and hear the story and some of the things that it's led to and see where it goes.
Sure. Well, so on my third tour in Afghanistan, I was a member of the Canadian Special Operations Regiment, which is a unit in CANSOFCOM, Canadian Special Operations Forces Command. It has 4 or 5 units in it, one of them being CSOR, which I was in, JTF-2, which is our Tier 1 Special Forces unit, a nuclear biological chemical warfare unit, an aviation helicopter unit, and a school. So I was in CSOR. I was on a foot patrol in near a village called Zangabad down in Panjway, which is the Horn of Panjway in southern Afghanistan and Kandahar. And it's in about 2010 to 2012, it was about the most dangerous place to be in Afghanistan. And on my 41st birthday, we were going out on a foot patrol, about a 10 or 12 man patrol. We were going out to do a presence patrol, it's called, which is just let the locals know you're there and let the enemy know that you're there and that you're looking for them. On that patrol, we found 2 IEDs that morning, and we cleared them both. We blew them in place. So we find them, we get as much intelligence about them as we can, and then we put a charge on top of them, and then we draw back, we blow them up, and then move forward through the gap that we've created. And we did that twice that morning. And then we finished the patrol. We were headed back to camp. And I got some information that there were possibly a couple of guys on a hill behind us, and they could have a heavy weapon. And you never want anybody to have the high ground behind you, particularly if they're, you know. So we were moving to engage them, moving to contact, to a gunfight. And our dog handler, who was an American contractor, triggered an IED. He stepped on a pressure plate about 6 feet off my left shoulder. He lost both his legs. I don't remember much of the blast. I remember smoke and fire coming up my left side, and then it sort of went, and this horrifically loud noise, and then it went black. I came to a couple of minutes later, and I was bleeding. I had some shrapnel holes, badly concussed. As it turns out later, there's 3 dead spots on the left side of my brain from the blast. I lost 50% of my hearing. I had some nerve damage. And PTSD at the end of the day. I was medically evacuated. We were, 3 of us and the dog, were medically evacuated to the Rural 3 Hospital at Kandahar Airfield. We went through medical procedures. Bobby, who stepped on the IED, lived. He lost both his legs. A couple of us, including myself, went through debridement where they're removing shrapnel and stuff from me and another buddy. It was mostly what they call biological shrapnel, which means it was pieces of Bobby's leg bones and rocks. It wasn't actually like metal shrapnel. It was a lot of it was pieces of leg bone. So I had taken that in the face and up the arm. Couple of days of recovery, I went back out to start patrolling again, and was really not acting right. And it was noticed that I wasn't acting right. So we went in for back into Kandahar Airfield. We flew back in.
What do you mean acting right?
Well, I guess I was zoning out. I was not speaking well. I had aphasia. I would drop words all the time. And that's not good for a guy who's a communicator. You know, when you're the communications sergeant, it's not good when you can't speak correctly. So we went back into Kandahar Airfield, which is the huge, safe, fairly secure base in Kandahar City. It had like, I don't know, 10, 15,000 troops in it at the time. And I had some MRIs on my head, and they said that, you know, that I had traumatic brain injuries. I had a psych eval and the shrink there. For the first time ever, I told the shrink the truth, what I thought. The question I think was, you know, so what do you think of Afghanistan at this point in time? And my answer was, I don't care. I'd burn this place to the ground. I don't give a damn about this place, men, women, children. I didn't care. I was so pissed off from being wounded having lost friends and stuff, and from Bobby being so maimed. And they just said, you know, you can't be here. We're gonna have to medically repatriate you. If certainly for my psych situation, but also for the brain injuries. So I was sent home to Canada, and I proceeded to go through some rehabilitation. I had really bad aphasia. I knew the word dog, but I couldn't say the word dog, but I could say aphasia. It was like really strange. I say things like, I asked my wife, you know, about supper one night, and I said, well, we'll have sea fish, not seafood and not fish, but sea fish. And there were just strange things coming up. And I was filled with rage, just violent rage. I was punching holes in every wall in my house. I was numbing with booze, a lot of vodka. And at one point in time, I was on 26 pills a day, psych meds, pain meds, anticonvulsives to try to stop nightmares, because I was waking up screaming three to four nights a week. My wife has been attacked and hit in her sleep, choked. And so my life was going downhill fast. It was a spiral. So the Army did what the Army does, which is try to get you help. We had one psychiatrist on the base in Petawawa, a single psychiatrist, 5,000 troops on a brigade to take care of an entire brigade of 5,000 troops, one psychiatrist, and that brigade is at war. And there were weeks where the flag never went past half staff in Petawawa because we just kept losing guys. Every couple of days, we'd lose more guys. So everybody back on base is watching their friends come home in boxes, and they've all been there too. Those guys have done 2, 3, 4 tours in Afghanistan, and they had one psychiatrist, and this poor bugger was run ragged. He did what he could, but I mean, what psychiatrists generally do is pharmaceuticals, right? And so I was on 26 pills a day. I tried a few different psychology things. I did cognitive behavior therapy. I did EMDR, which is where they have a light flashing in front of your face while you relive things. I tried a bunch of stuff and none of it worked. We then sort of move forward to 2016. I get released from the military medically. They're like, you know, you're obviously not going to be able to come back. So we're going to release you. I'm releasing. I'm a sergeant with 15 years in, and I'm going to get a medical release. That leads to another new host of problems, because your identity for a lot of people as soldiers is to have built up an identity as I am a soldier. That is what I do. I'm in this tribe, and now I'm out of the tribe. You know, the gate closes behind you. Probably the hardest day of my life. It was the day that the gate closed behind me at CSOR, the Special Operations Regiment, and I was no longer a member. That was heartbreaking for me because those are my tribesmen in there, and now I'm not one of them. Right? It's like you've been shunned and put out to pasture. So that now that I'm released, that's a new thing that's coming up, a new dynamic. And I struggled with it for years. And so the journey you were alluding to started about a year and a half ago. We were in Texas, and I was in a rough place. And I reached out to a friend of mine, Seb Lavoie, who's a former RCMP emergency response team sergeant major. And I reached out to him, and I said, I don't know what else to do, Seb. I'm at my wit's end. I've been reading about psychedelic therapies and stuff, and I just don't know what to do. And he linked me in with a couple of people who live in Tulum in Mexico, and they run an organization called Becoming OM, O-M. And they do microdosing, psilocybin microdosing mindfulness program. I was still on some medications at the time, and I was like, well, okay, let's try this. I got on board with it, and it's a really interesting program. So when I talk about microdosing, it is microdosing. It is sub-perceptual amounts of psilocybin, magic mushroom. You don't even feel it. It's not like a party. It's not like even, like I tell you, when I used to have to take Ativan, I felt that more than I ever felt a microdose. But it sort of lowers some walls between you and your psyche and your inner voices and stuff. So I went through the program. The program includes journaling, physical fitness, meditation, and mindfulness. So it's not just, you don't just take a microdose and this is like a new antidepressant and wow, this works. You know, you're putting in work through a program while you're taking this. By the end of the program, I was on zero medications. I came off all my pharmaceuticals. I was starting to sleep properly. I had gotten rid of a bunch of rage, and I was still having issues. And that's where the next step came, which was a trip to Peru to sit with ayahuasca, which is a heavy psychedelic. It's DMT, and it's administered by they call them maestros, but they're shaman from the Shipibo tribe in Peru. I did 5 ceremonies with them. Saw a bunch of crazy stuff, you know, psychedelics. You saw all kinds of crazy lights and things like that. But somewhere in that experience, I walked out of there, and I have, at this point in time, and I'm a year down the road from Peru now, no rage, no suicidal ideation. I used to have a voice in my head, would come into my head unbidden about 40 times a day to tell me to just finish this, just get it over with, end it. This is stupid. Why are you even bothering? That's gone. I haven't heard it in a year. I sleep. If I don't sleep, it's because I'm, you know, approaching 54 and I don't need so much sleep anymore, but I don't have nightmares. That's not a problem anymore. I don't have anxiety. My depression is pretty much gone. I'm not cured of PTSD. I don't think that there is a cure for PTSD, but I think that this treatment did more for me in 5 ceremonies, 5 nights than 11 years of any other modality ever did. So that was the next step, was trying this psychedelic therapy. And now I, as I'm retired and I live in Mexico, I volunteer as a mentor to anyone who's interested, but specifically focusing on first responders and veterans families for mindful microdosing of psilocybin. I've done a lot of podcasts about it. There's some discussion of me talking to possibly the Senate subcommittee on Veterans Affairs in Canada about it. I know they have pushed forward a letter to Veterans Affairs sort of demanding that Veterans Affairs speed up research into psychedelic therapy for injured and ill veterans. And I think that it really is a future in treatment of trauma. I think that there's a lot of, now not all of it is scientifically studied yet, but there is a whole lot of anecdotal evidence. I know U.S. Special Forces guys who are 4 years post doing psychedelic therapy, and they are living the best lives they could be living, considering some of them are missing legs, some of them are, you know, like serious traumas, and this is what worked for them.
I think if I look at the last, you know, 4 years, I think it's become pretty evident how much society is influenced by pharmaceuticals. And, you know, my wife's from the States, and when we crossed the border and we're in the hotel room the one night with the kids, I'm so unplugged from like regular television, heck, the radio, et cetera, that you just don't hear ads. And then you go to the United States and you see the paid for advertisements, and it's Pfizer this and it's Pfizer that, and it's this drug and it's that drug. And you're like, holy crap. I can't imagine 26 pills in a day. You know, I just cannot fathom that. How did you stumble into the world of, I don't know, alternative treatment, I'm going to label it, I think is probably safe to say. Like, how did you stumble into it? Because, I mean, 26 medications. Was there a breaking point? Was there somebody who said, you know, you got to try this? How did you find your way to that? And probably the second question is, like, how sad is it that, you know, the things that work get buried while 26 medications get jammed down your throat, and you're still having suicidal thoughts on top of a whole list of other problems?
So I had, I follow a lot of groups on Instagram, ex-US Special Forces guys, because that was sort of my community of special operations at the end of my career. And so I stumbled across a number of guys who were engaging in psychedelic therapy, or had engaged in psychedelic therapy. And so I started to get interested in it, and I started to read their stories and listen to their stories and listen to them on podcasts talking about what it had done for them. And I thought, that's better than 26 pills a day. That's better than this cereal bowl full of pharmaceuticals every day. I mean, like 26 pills a day, I was numb. I felt so okay. Now I'm not depressed, but I don't feel anything. And that's no way to live a life, right? Like that was unacceptable to me. So it just came to the point that it was A, unacceptable to me, and B, it wasn't working as well anymore. And I had seen all these other guys, Navy SEALs, US Green Berets, even Delta Force guys in the States who had sort of gone through these programs. And there was a program out there called Heroic Hearts that's run by ex-US service guys, and they cater to special operations guys, ex-special ops guys. So I just sort of started to do some research, and that was when I mentioned to Seb LeBlanc, and he said, I actually know some people who might be able to help you, and he linked me in with them. And you know, the idea that we try to shun or ban this stuff, I mean, that our parents from the 70s, my parents from the 70s, did us no favors when they treated all this stuff as party drugs, right? Like, you know, like let's just let loose and party with all this stuff. Because what happens then is that scares the powers that be, the government, the whoever. And what do they do with it? They start to put things on Schedule 2, or they ban it, or they make it criminalized. And when we criminalize it, we take away the ability to have learned from it. You know, we had an opportunity and we lost years of learning that we could have been picking up, you know, but I think that's changing now. We understand that this peoples, these ancient peoples in Peru and elsewhere have been using these substances for thousands of years and they work.
Well, there's definitely, you know.
So, you know, I mean, we're now sitting in a world where we're starting to recognize there's some value to psychedelic therapy. My concern here is that exactly what we're talking about, pharmaceutical companies, right? Because if psychedelic therapy starts to get studied, who's going to do the studying? Is it going to be pharmaceutical companies? One of the reasons some of these things work is because there's a spirit to the medicine. As you're engaging in the medicine, you're engaging in it with a sort of a spiritual component, engaging with the spirit of the medicine and the spirit of healing and stuff like that. And I think that when a pharmaceutical company or even a lab, even a university lab, decides it wants to study this stuff properly, all it's going to do is try to break down that molecule and give you that molecule. These aren't miracle molecules. They require work. You have to work in conjunction with them. So my big concern when we're coming up to things like the Senate Subcommittee on Veterans Affairs saying, we're going to study this for helping veterans. We already know it helps veterans. We have hundreds of veterans who it's helped. We already know how. Why do we need to study the hell out of this? Because if we study the hell out of this, are we in danger of it no longer working the way it works now? Why are we going to try to reinvent a wheel? And that would be my big concern. I think that if people are suffering from trauma, if people have got post-traumatic stress issues, whether you're a first responder or a veteran, no matter what, I think that you and you're not finding the modalities that you're currently using are helping, then maybe you should open your mind up and have a look at you know, alternative therapies such as psychedelic therapy. And I'd like to see them get a broader, sort of more widespread acceptance. But I think that we run the peril of removing some of their efficacy if we try to Western medicinize them. And that's, you know, I'm not a big pharma fan. And I think that if we put their hands in it, if we let them get their hands in it, they're going to mess it up. And I don't want to see that, because I know that's for me. Just anecdotally, it has worked so well. And I know so many others I've worked with who it has worked for them. Now I'm, you know, probably worked with 50 other veterans, and some of whom have had massive breakthroughs through psychedelic therapy. And I really am concerned that if Purdue Pharma wanted to get you on a microdosing thing, that it would not be as effective as if you were actually getting the medicine, the plant, as it's grown in nature, and working with people who understand the plant and understand the therapy aspect of it, rather than trying to just monetize it. And that's what pharmaceutical companies do. They monetize things, right? There's no reason people in the United States should be paying $10,000 a month for drugs for diabetes, but you know, a drug that costs next to nothing to make, but the money, follow the money. And I worry that the money's going to draw the psychedelic therapy in. So my hope is that we can be smart about it, and that people like me will continue to stand up and speak for it and say there's absolute healing available here. And that it'll get some more mainstream acceptance without us diluting it or letting it be monetized and changed by pharmaceutical companies. So, you know, I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk and tell sort of my story. It's, you know, it's a story that is common amongst veterans of the Canadian Forces, and certainly common amongst veterans of Afghanistan and Iraq. Traumatic brain injuries and PTSD are the signature injuries of those two wars. And I picked up both of them, and I know a lot of guys who have them. And I think that it's something that, you know, PTSD has stigmas behind it, and we talk a lot about releasing that stigma, getting rid of it. But the way to really get the stigma out of it and allow people to ask for help and to move towards help, whether that's psychedelic or not, is for shows like this, for people to be able to have a voice, guys like me to be able to have a voice and say, you know what, it's okay to admit that you were ill or that you were wounded or that you weren't okay after 24 months in Afghanistan. It's okay to say, hey, I'm not all right. I need to take a knee. I need some help. And for people to be able to reach out. And I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to use my voice.
Well, folks, that's going to do it. We had some audio visual problems with Toby's connection. And so I wanted to finish off the chat, but at least we got to have some final thoughts from Toby. And I appreciate you all hopping in today. And we'll catch up to you on the next one. Till then.